This podcast is from the Overnights program on ABC Local Radio. I'm Tim Brunero.
Each month, Dr. Keith Suter, Managing Director of the Global Directions Think Tank, joins us on Overnights to discuss and analyse the latest international events and to answer your questions. So if you'd like to ask a question of Dr. Keith Suter, maybe save it up, just give us a couple of minutes to have a yak, and then we'd like to get you on the blower and on the wireless. Tonight, we'll be looking at a range of issues from Syria and the UK and right through to the US elections and, of course, the Fiji cyclone. Keith Suter joins us on the line. G'day, Keith.
Yes, good morning, Tim.
Lovely to have you on the wireless this morning.
Thank you.
What's going on with Syria? It's such a fascinating and fraught sort of area. Can you? I know that they're talking about a ceasefire, but can you just take us through the main groups of combatants? Because there's about six, isn't there?
Oh, there's more than that, and it depends on how you do your counting. That's part of the confusion. It goes back to the so-called Arab Spring that got underway at the end of 2010. So you then had rebellions that broke out quite suddenly in a number of the Arab states in North Africa. So you have Tunisia, Libya, Egypt. And then the fourth one to run into problems was Syria. And the Assad regime has managed to hold on to power in a way that the previous three governments that I've just mentioned all were overthrown. And the Egyptian case went in 18 days. Unbelievable. He's held on now, it's getting into 5 years. And what we see, it's part of the complication of it, as some of us were warning even at the time, is that it's hardwired into a number of other issues. So what you've seen in the initial stage were people who were part of the Arab Spring revolutionaries. In other words, generally speaking, young, alienated young people concerned about unemployment who wanted a better life, who decided to come out on the streets and then rebelled. So it started off much as we saw elsewhere in parts of the Middle East. So that's the essential starting point. But then what we've also seen in the Middle East is that the young people, although they're very brave, very energetic, lack organizational skills. And so that gives opportunities for other groups to exploit the chaos. So what we see in Tunisia, as we've seen elsewhere, has been the Islamic State getting involved. Now, the Islamic State began over the border in Iraq, and so it was very easy for it to set up business, so to speak, there, as distinct from having to wait a few years before it gets set up in Libya, as it has now done. So the second struggle that's underway is between the so-called Islamic State, which is the hard-line aspect of Al-Qaeda. It's hard to imagine another group being even more extremist than Al-Qaeda. But you've also got Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, operating there as well. So they are both fighting Assad, but they also fight each other. Then you've got even the wider context. You've got Saudi Arabia supporting some of the groups that are operating in Syria because they are Sunni. And you've got the Assad regime being supported by Iran because it's Shia. Well, it's Alawite, but it's essentially a Shia government. So we see, therefore, a continuation of a 13-year-old civil war that's gone on within Islam. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon his name, when he died, did not nominate his successor or explain how he should be replaced. So we've had this dispute, which goes deep into the roots of Islam, between the Sunni and the Shia, sometimes resulting in war, other times they're able to coexist together. Now, there is now, in effect, a Shia crescent, because you begin with Iran, and then you go up through Iraq. This is one of the big controversies about the UK-US-Australia invasion in 2003. That Saudi Arabia refused to support that invasion because they said if you go ahead with all this nonsense of one person, one vote, then the country will be dominated by the Shia. The Shia, although they make up the majority in Iraq, have never actually run that country. So after Winston Churchill created it, after World War I, it was run by a Sunni king. Then you had various Sunni-dominated military taking over it. Saddam Hussein comes into that category. And so the problem with one person, one vote, is, from Saudi Arabia's point of view, is you hand Iraq over to Iran. So you then have Iran, Iraq, and then you go up to Syria, and then you move across to Hezbollah. So it's interesting that you've got that other overlay of the struggle. And then yet another dimension to this is the role of Russia, because Russia is trying to reinvent itself on the international scene. You remember the Cold War rivalry with the United States. Then it fell into chaos. Now it has a leader who wants to reestablish Russia on the international scene. And it's Russia that's making much of the running on Syria, because you've got an American president, Obama, who does not want to get involved with troops on the ground in Syria. There's a lot of bombing going on, and you can imagine CIA is involved behind the scenes, but he does not want to have troops on the ground. And so it's the Russians who are basically doing a lot of the heavy lifting. And so that's yet another dimension to the struggle. Now, what is interesting is that this has now created the largest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. And some of the countries have now got together in negotiations and at least created a ceasefire that enables aid to be taken into some of the besieged towns in Syria. Now, the negotiations didn't involve the hardliners, Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, but it has involved the Syrian authorities and some of the other anti-Syrian parties that are operating. And by the looks of it, the ceasefire is holding, and some relief is now being brought in to those people who have been besieged, some of them for 4 years, 5 years.
So it's not in areas that the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda are operating in. And I think in the Syrian theatre, Al-Qaeda is called Jabhat al-Nusra.
Nusra, yeah.
Yeah. And then you've mentioned the Syrian army, of course, Assad's forces. We've mentioned Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra. But there's also Syrian rebels. And then there's this strange group which seems to be made up of ISJN and rebels. And then, of course, you've got Kurdish forces as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I should have added that. That's another dimension. Sorry, that's yet another dimension. So at the end of World War One, again, going back to the breakup of the Ottoman, the Turkish Empire, the Kurds were promised their own homeland. Now, that deal was never followed through. The newly formed Turkey decided to ignore that agreement. And so the Kurds claim, at 30 million, claim to be the largest indigenous people without their own homeland. So Kurdistan, or at least the area dominated by the Kurds, would be eastern Turkey, northern Iraq, northern Iran. Now, what is interesting is that the Kurds had tended to be pro-American at the time of the tensions between America and Saddam Hussein. They're the ones who are putting up the best fighting. And so you had a number of people like myself who said, well, look, instead of Western troops going in the ground, let's just provide more weapons for the Kurds to continue to do their fighting against the Islamic State. But Turkey is worried that if the Kurds get too effective in Syria and Iraq, that'll create a precedent for the Kurds in eastern Turkey to then to continue their rebellion and try to redraw that map to create that separate proposed Kurdistan, which would take out eastern Turkey. So you're right, there is yet another aspect to this. The Kurds, who are doing a lot of the heavy lifting on the ground and being quite successful.
You do wonder whether they do have the right to self-determination. I mean, isn't that one of the universal human rights, the idea that you can be in, you know, have sovereignty over your own area? If there are Kurds spread over Turkey, Syria, Iraq and Iran, I mean, what is the likelihood that they might actually get a chance to have their own state?
Pretty small, I would have thought. Because, well, up until the chaos since the 2003 Iraq invasion, I would have said it was pretty small, because they fought among themselves, they were not well organized, and the existing governments wanted to hold on to the current boundaries. They didn't want to lose any land. But since the US, UK, Australia invasion in 2003, everything has changed. Suddenly the Kurds are winning international admiration, and the borders that were drawn up, to which I've been referring, Iraq, etc., Those borders were drawn up at the end of World War One. They are now being redrawn by the Islamic State. And what we're seeing is the Kurds are perhaps saying, well, if we're going to redraw the boundaries, let's redraw it in favour of Kurdistan. So Kurdistan might emerge out of all this chaos, at least in part of those countries to which I've referred, such as Iraq and Syria.
You did talk there about that Sykes-Picot Treaty and the French and the British drawing those lines on the map post the Ottoman breakup. That a lot of people have said we're very poor choices, that Iraq has got three distinct peoples, the Kurds we've talked about, the Sunnis in the middle and the Shia at the bottom, if you like.
Yeah.
And that only really a very strong leader could have held it together, because the state itself doesn't really have any internal logic in terms of the peoples that are in it. Are you one of those people that buys into that theory that Saddam Hussein, the only person who could have held a country like that together is someone who was an ultra-strong man?
Well, we know that Saddam Hussein was saying to his own generals before the 2003 invasion that no one would be mad enough to invade him because governing Iraq is so difficult. And he said democracy is not going to work in Iraq. So we know that he was saying that. Of course, he hadn't counted on there being a George Bush. But he was saying, look, no one would be mad enough to try to remove me because you need a strong person to run this country. So what you've got to bear in mind is you're basically, in political science terms, we talk about a pre-modern society, a modern society, and perhaps a post-modern one. Certainly a pre-modern one is a society which is based mainly on tribes or clan loyalty or family loyalty. Then you develop a sense of national identity. So in Europe, we use the date of 1648 for the beginning of this new system of government. So at that point, you then get people very consciously thinking of themselves as being British or at least English or Scottish or French, whatever. So at that point, if you look at the Australian case, we're a modern state. So we may have disagreements between, say, New South Wales and Victoria on certain matters, but at the end of the day, we're all essentially Australian. You don't get that in Iraq. One of the problems for Iraq at the moment is there are very few Iraqis living in Iraq, but you've got people who have loyalties outside of the nation. In other words, they may have it to their family, they may have it to their religion. Now, eventually, Iraq could become a modern state in the way that we talk about it, with a clear sense of national identity. As you say, it was the country was invented just over 100 years ago, or just under 100 years ago, by Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, when they broke up that vast Ottoman Empire, put together three Turkish provinces, vilayet. And then, as you say, they were not necessarily a logical way to put those three provinces together. Churchill himself referred to Iraq as an ungrateful volcano. It was one of the occasions the British have had to use gas in warfare. We used to gas the Iraqi natives in the 1920s as a way to try to control them. So it was very unhappy to start with. And then what we have found is that you need to have a strong person at the top to hold the whole show together.
Very interesting stuff. We're speaking to Dr. Keith Suter, Managing Director of the Global Directions Think Tank. And, of course, you listen to ABC Overnight. So my name's Tim. How are you going? In a few moments, we will ask you for your contribution. Maybe you'd like to ask a question or make a comment. That number will be forthcoming to you in just a few moments. Just before we leave Syria, can I quickly ask you about the ceasefire and the impact of sustained Russian bombing just before that ceasefire?
Well, the Russians, as I say, are doing a lot of the action within Syria. They're obviously, as usually the case when you negotiate a ceasefire that takes place in a few days in the future, you make the most of the scope for violence, which is what the Russians did. But at the moment, as we speak, it looks as though the ceasefire seems to be holding. But remember, all it's doing is enabling aid to get in. It's not sorting out the deeper problems. And we have a very clear contrast between the Russians. They know what they want. They want to keep Assad in power because the only territory that Russia still has in the Middle East are the bases in Syria. So they're very clear as to what they want. The problem is the West is not clear as to what it wants. Obama has talked about the need for Assad to go, but he's unclear. So the Russians know what they're about. They know what they're going to do. The Americans are all over the place in terms of having a clear end game in mind. So these bigger issues still are left unresolved. Should the Assad regime continue? Should somehow it be allowed to continue, but with less territory, perhaps some territory being controlled by Islamic State? My own feeling is that Islamic State won't end up controlling territory for the long term. We know from history that violent revolutionary regimes ultimately turn the violence on themselves. But it makes life very difficult for those who are caught up in that struggle. But then, of course, as we've touched on, is the whole issue of whether the Kurds will then try to break away under this term of, you know, negotiating a separate agreement. There's a separate piece of territory clearly controlled by the Kurds. Should they be allowed to hold on to what they've managed to acquire? Mm. That is in Syria. That still leaves separately the issue of the Kurds in eastern Turkey and in Iraq.
Yes, I think it's an important point. I don't think many people realise that the Russians are so interested in Syria because they literally have ships. They've got naval facilities with you know, in Syria, in cooperation with Syria. And, of course, it'll be a major... It would crimp their strategic style if they weren't able to have those ships there. So a very kind of obvious and self-interested motivation for them in terms of what they're doing in that conflict. Can we move on, Dr. Keith Sitter, to the UK and the EU vote? I know that those in the UK will vote in a referendum on whether to stay in the European Union on the 23rd of June. What's this all about?
Well, this is actually the second time the British have had a vote. They had another vote 40 years ago when, at that time, it was the Labour government in power, Harold Wilson's government. So the UK entered the European Union as a most reluctant recruit in 1973. If you throw your mind back even further, Winston Churchill had talked about the need for a unified Europe, gave a very famous speech on that topic, but was very unclear as to what the UK's role would be, because the UK claims to have a special relationship with the United States. And so the UK has always been ambiguous in what its relationship would be, because you've got obviously conservatives, small-c conservatives in the UK saying, well, most of our problems have always ever come from Europe. Why do we want to link up with those people? So they've always been a reluctant country. They stood aside from the earlier negotiations to create the common market. And then they said, all right, let's give it a go, reluctantly. And then the French president, De Gaulle, said, no, we're not going to have you. So they were then excluded. But then eventually the whole thing, De Gaulle left office, the whole thing was reopened again. The British joined under a conservative government, Edward Heath. But it was a very unpopular decision, I think, for some people. He, in fact, lost office. So then the incoming Labour government said, look, we'll have a referendum on whether or not we should stay. And so the referendum took place, and the British decided to stay. But they've been very grudging partners all the way along. They've never been enthusiastic Europeans. Mrs. Thatcher was downright hostile towards them. So the problem now is that it's the Conservative government that's in power and has still got splits within it. So it's very much an internal dispute. You can't say this is very clearly a Labour-Conservative issue and any more than it was the previous time, because both parties have got splits down the middle on this issue. So David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, has said, look, we will have a referendum on June 23. So even within the Labour Party in the opposition, you've still got some people who just want to get out of Europe. But I think this is really an issue to help David Cameron, because clearly the UK Independence Party, which wants to get out of all of those arrangements, did very well in last year's election. And so David Cameron is caught in this tension, as was Harold Wilson 40 years ago, between some people who want to stay in and those who want to get out. And so Mr. Cameron said, we will have this vote on June 23. And then we will just see what will happen. Of course, a lot will flow on from this. I assume David Cameron will resign if he loses the referendum. He will not want to spend the rest of his time in office. He's got another 4 years to go, working out how to get out of the European Union. So there'll be a change, obviously.
Because he personally wants to stay in.
He wants to stay within it. And, of course, a lot of the business interests in the United Kingdom want to stay in as well.
But he's sorry to cut you off, but he has also said to his ministers, you are free. It's almost a kind of conscience vote situation. You are free to take either side, which I think has seen the spectacle of ministers contradicting him, which they've never done before. I suppose my question would be something around why are they so keen to get out? And didn't they just negotiate? Didn't he just get back from Europe negotiating some gear to make it even sweeter?
Well, this is what part of his technique for trying to stay in, that he said, look, I will renegotiate the terms. He was very unclear, I've got to say, when I was talking to some EU people in October, November last year. They said, well, we're not quite sure what it is the British don't like, except they don't like Europe. So he was then forced to clarify exactly what he wanted to renegotiate. He ended up with this new deal, which basically says the British will not be obliged to deepen their relationship with the European Union. They will not be expected to join the euro, which I think was a smart decision by the Conservatives all those years ago, not to go into the euro single currency. Will not be expected to take in large numbers of asylum seekers. You know, the Germans have perhaps taken in up almost 1 million people last year from Syria, mainly, that we've just touched on. So in a sense, what he's been able to do is to, in this new deal with Europe, be able to say to his own voters, look, we have been able to create a special status for the UK, whereby we will remain within the UK but not be fully absorbed, within the European Union. We will be able to be slightly separate from it. And so my guess is that when we get the wording of the question, which it looks like, should the UK remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union, it'll be on the basis of the new deal that he has negotiated. Has it been enough to guarantee that the British will remain within Europe? We just don't know. But obviously the voters will need to think through this. And a lot of the voters at the moment are complaining they're confused about this, which should be expected. So that's what they will vote on.
Any ramifications for Australia if the Brits leave the EU?
No, they're not going to recreate the Commonwealth relationship. Well, the Commonwealth relationship was a weird relationship. It still continues to exist. It's the reason I'm in Australia. I came out under the Commonwealth Research Fellowship Program, which is an educational cooperation program. It still continues. So only the British could have invented the Commonwealth. Very different from the way the French had their relationship with their ex-colonies in Africa. So the British invented the Commonwealth. But I think if Britain were to leave, I think it would force... Well, it depends on which position you take. Would it force the British to become more engaged with affairs outside of Europe? Would it enable them instead to just become very insular? There's always this tension within the UK between, on the one hand, the children who would go overseas to run the empire and those who would just stay at home and marry and only move a few miles down the street. So there is always this element of insularity within the United Kingdom. The other dimension to this, it won't be so much affecting Australia very much, but it'll affect Scotland, because Scotland has said we are very much in favour of the European Union. If the UK votes to pull out, we want to have a new referendum on Scotland, because we want to become independent in order that we can rejoin the European Union in our own right. So this is a thing that can have all sorts of knock-on effects, but I don't think Australia need be too worried one way or the other.
Now, of course, the race is underway for the Republican and Democratic presidential nominations. Where are we up to? Today is Super Tuesday.
So Super Tuesday is when you get a huge number of states that are voting. So remember, we're still the first stage. It seems to run on for eternity. We're still in the first stage of the presidential election. So the election is in two stages. The first stage is the primary, where what you're trying to do is to get the status, the nomination of your party. So that'll go on to the summer, the northern summer, that is. And then once the parties have selected their candidates, there are a number of people running, I might say, for the presidency who are not Democrats or Republicans, but they never get any publicity. But anyway, so we only focus on the two major parties. So the Democrats and the Republicans are in the process of, it's what in Australian terms we call pre-selection, except it's involving the general public, or at least those who already signed up to be a Republican or a Democrat, therefore eligible to vote or take part in caucuses. Then the second stage is called the general election, and that'll run from the northern summer through until November, and then we get the election in November.
Yeah, so interesting, that whole idea that you can register as a Republican or Democrat. You're not a member of the party, that's quite different, as I understand it. So you could register, if they had the same system here in Australia, you could register as a Labor or a Liberal Party voter, and that would allow you to vote in the caucuses, I think I'm using the right term, or the pre-selection, as you call it. And I think the Labor Party in Australia has tried something along these lines in the last couple of years.
Well, they have. It's just, it's very interesting that the UK, Australia, this is Kevin Rudd, Mark II, introduced this as a way of avoiding party coups. In other words, avoiding somebody getting rid of him again, as they'd done before. So leadership is also determined partly by support from within the mass membership. The weirdest example of this is what's gone on in the UK, where the UK has got a system for electing a leader through the Westminster colleagues, but also involving anybody who wants to join the Labour Party. And with the Labour defeat last year in the general election, they used this system, and they ended up with a slate of names, general dissatisfaction because all the names seem to be coming out of Casting Central. And so this weird outsider, Jeremy Corbyn, when I was back in the UK recently, I met somebody who'd known him for many years who live in Islington. And Corbyn is a really unusual fellow. He's been in Parliament for donkey's years, never got anywhere because he's seen as far too much of a loose cannon, but came to prominence some years ago when there was a parliamentary expenses scandal where they found that some members of Parliament were charging expenses for cleaning out the moat in their castle, on their estates, etc. And down the bottom of the people claiming expenses was Jeremy Corbyn, who I think was probably claiming 3 and 6 pence for his bicycle clips. He's never owned a car.
Yes, he's a very interesting character.
Suddenly people have found an honest politician. They were amazed. So who is this Jeremy Corbyn? So this guy suddenly flashes across the firmament as this honest politician, and not the usual crook that you get with parliamentary expenses, as we see in so many countries. And then last year, at the end of last year, when the Labour Party was calling for nominations, at the very, very last minute, people put forward Jeremy Corbyn's name. And to the surprise of the party bosses, this guy got elected, not through support at Westminster. His own colleagues loathe him, but through the mass membership.
Well, that's what's interesting about it, of course, that you've got his team, and this is most unlike our democracy, his team don't want him to be leader.
I mean,
he doesn't have a majority of his own party.
No.
Can we just put our minds back to the US elections? Donald Trump, of course, looking very well, like he's going very well, rather, in the primaries we've seen so far. Can he be beaten now? Can Cruz or Rubio or someone else come back?
Well, we will find out today, because being Super Tuesday, we've got so many nomination votes up for grabs in the various states that are coming up for election. We will see after today on both sides how the candidates that are going, the two front runners, as you say, are Donald Trump, and then also we've got Mrs. Clinton. And so with the 11 states up for grabs, then this will certainly, by the time we get the results, which will be tomorrow or perhaps the day after, we will see whether or not the other candidates are still going to continue or whether Trump becomes inevitable and is just on this incredible roller coaster and just running through under momentum. You know, we've already seen Jeb Bush, who is the establishment favourite. He's already stood down. So they've already knocked him out. So it is quite a machine. And I find Donald Trump fascinating because it'll be the first time for decades that the United States would have elected a person who has no political experience. In other words, hasn't been a senator or a state governor or a member of the lower house, or has a military background. So Eisenhower, for example, was never a politician, but he had obviously a military career. I think you need to go back to someone like Herbert Hoover, who unfortunately was the president at the time of the Great Depression, who was a disaster, but of course a legend in Western Australia. That's where he made his money. But Herbert Hoover was probably the last business person to get into the White House. So it's very rare that we get someone like Donald Trump. And of course, Mrs. Clinton will also set up her own results, her own record through, you know, being the first lady ever to make it into the White House. So it'll be, by the looks of it, if they are the two main candidates in November, they're going to be very, very interesting. History will be set one way or the other.
Yes, he does remind me a little bit of Ross Perot, who had a crack a few times sort of 20 years ago.
Yeah.
A bit of a billionaire candidate who didn't seem to have much of an allegiance to anyone. He actually did run as an independent, as Trump has threatened to do, should he not actually get the Republican nomination. How significant was it that the New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, who was a candidate, has thrown his weight behind Trump, has endorsed him?
Well, George Bush Sr. used to refer to the big momentum. And you build that up and you then become inevitable. And I think Chris Christie has done this deal very early on in the expectation that perhaps when Trump is looking for appointments, he might be one of the favoured sons. So I realise it's not very high-minded, but, you know, we're dealing with politicians. And so I think Chris Christie is getting in very early as a supporter in the expectation that if Trump gets in, he will be treated well. He might get an ambassadorial position or something like that. Well, depends what he wants.
A ministry or a secretary of whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so he's already doing his dealing. And, of course, it adds to the big momentum. You know, already the other Republicans can say, well, look, that's the way the trend is moving. We've got to jump on that bandwagon, otherwise we're going to be left behind. Mm. Could I just float with you a thing that has been put to me a few weeks ago, which I've been publicising, is a theory that if it's going to be Trump and Clinton at the conventions, respective conventions, that both the bosses in the respective parties will be so traumatized by that that they will then find some alternative way through what's called convention gridlock. In other words, that if the convention is looks like it's going to be stalemated, they can then pull a rabbit out of the hat. On the Republican side, it might be Mayor Bloomberg, who's recently stood down as mayor of New York, who's a very rich Republican but moderate and won't scare the voters in the general election. And then on the Democrat side, because Bernie Sanders is a self-proclaimed socialist, he will certainly worry people in the general election. And Mrs. Clinton is clearly hated by a lot of people in the United States. So they would then pull a rabbit out of the hat. And it may be that Joe Biden, the vice president, who's ruled himself out, might reluctantly come forward to serve. And perhaps with John Kerry, currently the foreign the Secretary of State, being the vice presidential running mate.
Mm. Yes, you said John Kerry, right? Yes, I've heard those theories. I've also been reading a couple of stories recently, Keith. By the way, we're speaking to Dr. Keith Suter about all things international. One of the things I've been reading recently has been around the idea that if Trump becomes the nominee for the Republicans, and that looks very likely, and as you say, in the next 24 or 48 hours, we'll find out for sure, the candidate who would have a much better chance against him is Bernie Sanders. And the article goes on to sort of say, and that's because they are Sanders has the kind of sloganeering populist approach that Hillary Clinton doesn't have, and she'll spend the whole time getting beaten up by Trump as he makes his outlandish claims, whereas Bernie, I mean, I suppose what they're saying is you've got to fight fire with fire, and Bernie's got that fire. He won't be picking away and trying to debate a style, you know, counter Trump, because that's not the way you fight Trump. The way you fight him is just by even more bizarre and outlandish and aggressive claims.
Yeah, and I think both the popularity of both outsiders, a bit like Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, the popularity of the outsiders shows that people are sick of the politicians coming out of central casting, that you're basically replacing these lookalike figures as we do in Australia. We've got a very narrow gene pool in Australia. The pleasure I have in covering in American politics is that any adult American, when they're born in America, can run for election. Providing to get the money behind you. And so the American gene pool is much broader. And I think that a lot of Americans are saying, look, we're just sick of machine politicians because Australia lives on those. But this is the country which says, look, we're now sick of them and we want something radically different. And that's why I think an election campaign between Saunders and Trump would make for great debates. And I find it fascinating that the oldest candidate actually gets the youngest supporters because the young, idealistic people are voting for this old man.
Yes, I've seen that. He's 74, I think I'm correct. But it's not like the rest of them are that much younger, Keith. I mean, they're sort of, you know, in their 60s and stuff. It's not like they're, you know, he's that much older. But anyway, just finally, before we jump into Iran, and by the way, this might be about the time we open up our phone lines, 1-300-222-702. 1-300-222-702 is our number to call if you'd like to make a comment to Keith on something that we've been talking about, or perhaps you'd like to ask a question. You're so welcome, 1-300-222-702. And of course, you can text us as well, 0467-922-702. Just one final question on America. President Barack Obama, of course, in his last year of his presidency, what can he do in this last year?
Well, mainly in foreign policy. I think that presidents usually realize that they get stymied on domestic policy, that they don't really have much control. For example, he has no control over the gun issue, which people obviously feel very strongly about, pro and con. But when it comes to foreign policy, a president has greater room for maneuver, as Richard Nixon showed with opening up to China. So this is where I think Obama, who will be seen as, I think, one of the least successful American presidents, although he introduced some changes on healthcare. But generally speaking, his main claim to fame is that he kept the Republicans out of office for 8 years. But it has certainly, he's tried to improve relations with Burma, Myanmar. He's improved relations with Cuba. He's improved relations with Iran, which he needs to do if he's going to get Iran's assistance in sorting out Syria. And, of course, this has been reflected in the recent result in Iran, where the moderates have also supported that deal. So that's been good news for him on that point of view. What would be really dramatic would be for his to fly to North Korea to stitch up a deal there. But I guess the leader there is so eccentric that he probably wouldn't want to do that. But that's basically all he can do. And even in the case of Cuba, you know, you've got legislation that are imposing sanctions, which will require congressional support. And he just doesn't get that much support within Congress. So it's going to be a very difficult lame duck year. All presidents have lame duck years. Their final year in office, they can't get legislation through. That's why Ronald Reagan was right when he said, look, I've got 4 years in office. We're going to do everything in the first year. And then we'll cruise along for the next three. And then, of course, to his great joy, then got re-elected. So you then go through that cycle all over again. But by the fourth year, you are a lame duck. And that's Obama's problem. So he'll spend plenty of time traveling around the country, around the world, meeting people, and be thinking of his post-presidential career, the presidential library, and the legacy that he'll be leaving.
Fascinating stuff. Sally wants to ask, how can Donald Trump be supported by white supremacists and then get the black vote? Is that a fair summation, Sally?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, he's been questioned about it. He's not backing down. He's pretending like he doesn't know anything about David Duke or them.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just really hilarious how anyone can think that the Republicans aren't going to get anywhere near a vote if they even count on black people. And even other ethnics are going to look at that situation and say, hold on a second, I may not be black, but I could be next.
Yeah. Let's get Keith's...
Absolutely, I agree. What is interesting is the United States is now becoming a nation of minorities. Those seen very much as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country, that is changing, particularly with the influx of people from Central America and Latin America. And it's also reflected even in the candidates for the Republicans. So it's very interesting how we're getting this change. But at the moment, obviously... don't forget that voting is not compulsory. So this is a key thing to bear in mind. So half of the Americans won't bother to vote in November. More Americans vote in American Idol than vote in presidential elections. So what Trump is wanting to do is to make sure that he gets the angry white vote to come out and support him. And who knows, there may be some rich blacks who say, yes, let's support him because he's a person who's done well with his money and we need that as a role model. Because we don't like having our fellow African Americans living on welfare. Mm. So he may well pick up a few black votes. Very small. He's going to be picking up a lot of neo-Nazi ones as well. But then extremist candidates on the right always do.
It's a fascinating area. David wants to head back to the Middle East. G'day, David.
Hi, Tim, and hi, Dr. Suda. Few quick points or comments. One was why the United States tolerates the religious intolerance of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
The second point was why. What did it say about the Turks that they were in the Battle of Kobane? They were prepared to just let the Kurds sweat it out instead of attacking ISIS. And the last question was, what is the actual plight of the Christians in Syria, the ones that remain?
So three questions on Saudi Arabia. The Americans have had a special relationship with Saudi Arabia since 1945. In the 1930s, oil was found in Saudi Arabia by an American company, or at least American explorers. And in 1945, a deal was made between the American president, Roosevelt, one of his last activities, in fact, with the leader of Saudi Arabia, whereby the Americans promised the defense of Saudi Arabia, providing Saudi-supplied oil to the United States. That means, therefore, the Americans are very reluctant to criticize Saudi Arabia. A lot of Saudi Arabia money is invested in the United States. And indeed, the Bush family have long links with Saudi oil money. So that's the reason they turn a blind eye to the brutal behavior of Saudi Arabia, which actually also links in with your idea about the Christians in Syria. Don't forget that in Saudi Arabia, you can't be a Christian either. You can't... wear any Christian regalia publicly. So it's a very hypocritical approach for the Americans to complain about Islamic State carrying out beheadings when they do so on a regular basis in Saudi Arabia. In regards to Turks and Kurds and the siege of Kobani, absolutely appalling. Turkish soldiers were looking on as though they were just watching a football match. Of course, what is significant from the Turkish point of view is they're hoping both sides just wipe out each other. They'd had no support for either side, so they were just happy to see the violence go on. In terms of the Christians in Syria, absolute tragedy. We're talking about one of the oldest Christian communities in the Middle East. And, of course, they're very much losing out. And, well, generally, I think, in the Middle East, as life is becoming more and more hostile towards them. I think probably, insofar as there are Christians involved in politics, they will be supportive of the Assad regime, not because he's a nice person, but because under the Islamic State, they're going to be even more persecuted. So they're sticking with the devil they know rather than the gamble with the devil they don't know.
Thank you very much, Dr. Suda.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good on you, David. Nice to hear from you. Okay, can we quickly, I don't know, we've only got a couple of minutes here, Doctor, but maybe we could go to Fiji, given that they are in our region. Where are we up to with the leadership and political situation, and what impact will the cyclone have on that, if any?
A separate issue. As you know, we've had a dictatorship in Fiji, moving now towards democracy. Australia at one point was leading the international campaign to isolate Fiji, to encourage it to go back to being a democracy. the problem has been that China is improving its relations with the South Pacific generally, as is Taiwan, by the way. So we've got our own little struggle going on between the two separate Chinese nations, trying to win friends and influence people. There's a lot of Chinese investment going into the South Pacific. And the Australians, I think, must have realised that if they're not careful, they're going to get frozen out because of this Chinese money. The Chinese don't go in there to lecture people on democracy and human rights, etc. They just go in to do a deal. I think the restoration, the work that's been going on, is obviously being done very well by Australians who are well equipped for this type of work. And there is, I think, also within Canberra, this feeling that Australia's destination or real role should be looking after the states within our immediate region. So you've got people who are saying, let's focus on the defence of Australia and our immediate region rather than get bogged down in wars within the Middle East. So what I find interesting is the way that Australia's been active in trying to help Fiji to recover in this work. It's been an absolute tragedy. And of course, some people would say this is the harbinger of the future, where you've got climate change, we're going to get even worse storms coming up into the future.
It's an absolutely fascinating area. Dr. Keith Suter, fascinating to talk to you as always. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on Overnights.
Thank you.
Dr. Keith Suter, a Managing Director with the Global Directions Think Tank, joining us on Overnights as he does every month or so with a couple of big dollops of wisdom and knowledge when it comes to the wider world.
And that's another podcast from the Overnights program on ABC Local Radio. I'm Tim Brunero. Thanks for listening.